So I realized something about the third season of Star Trek and watching our two episodes for this week, which I had never really kind of put together before.
Okay, so you've solved a mystery.
I did.
Captain Kirk solves mysteries like every week.
Star Trek has always erred on the side of pretentiousness in its title sometimes, but the third season has really gone above and beyond. We've had the Paradise Syndrome and The Children Shall Lead. Is there in truth no beauty? And the topper of them all, for the world is hollow and I have touched the sky.
I think they've just gotten a bunch of like 20-year-olds to write these episodes.
Oh, no, absolutely. These are like people that were living on Santa Monica Boulevard and needed 20 bucks and they wrote a Star Trek script.
It was either this or like give out blowjobs.
Yeah, and then later they did. To Gene Roddenberry, because he was a horn dog.
Oh, yeah. Ew.
But the more pretentious the title, the worse the episode. Yeah. I mean, we could even rank it, right? The Paradise Syndrome, the best of the lot. Is There in Truth No Beauty? Next. And The Children Shall Lead? Next worse. For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky? The worst episode so far.
But Paradise Syndrome, that was the Indian one, right?
I'm talking about what I thought about the episode.
I hated that fucking episode.
I don't care what you thought about
I liked the Truth Beauty one. You know that.
Do I?
Yes. I liked the blind lady. I thought she was kind of awesome.
But okay, so this week, our first episode is The Tholian Web. Pretty straightforward title. Nothing really pretentious about it. Very descriptive of the episode, kind of. And it's a good episode.
I think we need to coin the term good season three episode for it.
Yeah.
It's not a good Star Trek episode, but for season three, it's been one of the best.
I would say it's a good Star Trek episode. I would go so far as to say it's a good Star Trek episode.
I would say I enjoyed it on the level of the Romulan Commander one.
Yeah, it's a solid, middling Star Trek episode. It loses a few points because it does suffer from season three-itis in some parts.
We need to come up with a catchier name for that.
I know. We'll think about it off air and get back to you next week. I don't know. It's got a lot going on, and not in a bad way, because some Star Trek episodes that have a lot going on are really good. Like Journey to Babel, for example, has tons of plot, and that's a really good episode. This is nowhere near as good as Journey to Babel, but it's interesting.
There's a shitload of stuff happening in this episode, and it's one they actually do manage, number one, to have the various threads kind of tying into each other. It has several different minor antagonisms all compounding and making this gigantic problem.
It's one of those episodes which is kind of like having a bad day, right?
Yeah.
Like, you don't have a bad day because like your mother dies. I mean, that is a bad day, but most people have bad days because you wake up late, you burn your oatmeal, miss the
shower's
bus,
cold, you know, it's raining, you get to work late,
and you miss a meeting. Like, all these things compound, and that's exactly what happens in the Tholian Web.
It's a snowballing. They get this distress call from the ship. Kirk disappears, you know, they think he's dead. You have the Spock and Bones, you know, bashing against each other. You have the Tholian ambassador problem. You have
let's not forget about the sector of space they're in that's causing your brain to melt or whatever.
Yeah, like there's about seven things that are all, again, and they're all the same basic cause.
Yeah.
And
I love the antidote for the brain melting, by the way, which is basically nerve gas in whiskey.
Yes.
Which is great. And it gives us another opportunity to have Scotty be a raging alcoholic.
Yeah.
Because he takes it and he's like, will this mix well with scotch? Takes the bottle and just disappears. And we assume that a few hours later, he's wandering the halls of the Enterprise in a kilt.
I would assume that they're normally used to that by now. He's just kind of playing they hear, you know, a new crewman comes on. He says, you know, Captain, I'm hearing this, you know, eerie bagpipes. Oh, that's just Scotty, you know. Just ignore him. Like, if you ever encounter him, just, you know, speak softly to him. Tell him you're taking him to the bar, bring him back to his room, give him a glass of water, and, you know, that's your duty up for him. You know, that's it.
Now I'm picturing an episode of Star Trek where it's called, like, The Hills of Edinburgh. and then it turns out that it's actually just a joke.
Yeah.
And Scotty is just playing the bagpipes. That would be a comedy episode.
It would have Harry Mudd. Harry Mudd, as I was about to say.
He would be in the episode.
Oh, man. They should have, like, a reunion special where they have, you know, all of the great, and Baylock gets in on the action.
They really should, yeah.
I love how, yeah, Tranya's the cure for this, you know, nerve problem.
Pretty much,
Tranya's just solves everything.
So, I mean, what do you think? Okay, so let's talk about the Tholians, first of all, because they...
I liked them.
Yeah, they're cool.
They're creepy, and they have, I feel the Ambassador actually, they're not an evil species, because I think the Ambassador...
He's not an ambassador. He's a lieutenant or whatever.
The Tholian
dude. Loskeen, I think his name is.
Oh, God. I don't know a single character name in this entire series beyond, like, the main cast.
I was about to say, you know the main cast.
That's about it. I still have trouble with what's his name.
Oh, him. Yeah. Well, he's a lot of trouble.
Kirk.
Right.
You know, I think the Tholians genuinely believe this is their territory, and I think the Federation genuinely believes this is neutral space, and, you know, when they explain, look, we have a missing person here, you know, the Tholian lieutenant,
Loskeen.
Bagels and Lox goes and says he, is like, all right, you know, I'll give you the benefit of the doubt in the interest of interstellar amicability, and, you know, they attack the second it's out because, as Spock says, famous Tholian punctuality.
But, right.
You know, they have no reason to believe that the Federation isn't doing a trick because we've seen them do that to Romulan in space a few weeks back.
Yeah, true.
And
the thing is, it's interesting, right? Because I like the Tholians because, number one, they're different. Look different. And we don't really know anything about them. We don't know if that's actually what they look like.
But they're not humanoid.
They're not humanoid, right, exactly. So that's the thing. And I like the fact, did you notice there's a really interesting, because we're watching the remastered HD versions, and I prefer to watch the show with the original effects, even though they're really in bad quality in HD, but
it's charming.
Richard is watching them on Netflix, so that only has the remastered effects. So I watch the remastered effects, so we're watching the same thing. And they actually kept the original optical work for the Tholian. That wasn't retouched in any way.
It looked really cool.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because if you notice, there's like these heat lines that are coming up, kind of implying that the Tholians live in a very, very hot environment, which is one of those little touches that I really like about it. I didn't notice
that. It looked very like, you know, 60s trippy special effects, and I thought that was cool because you know, I love that shit.
Yeah.
It's one of the reasons The Alternative Factor is my favorite episode of this series.
Oh, absolutely. But I really like the Tholians because we don't know a lot about them, but the little bit about them, we really do get a sense of what they're like as a culture. We know that they're punctual. We know that they're willing to listen. But we also know that they're maybe kind of violent. We're not sure.
Well, I think for the Tholians, things are very black and white. You know, they go at literally the minute that, you know, Spock says that the situation should be resolved. They see it not happening and they figure, all right, you know, they broke their word and they don't listen to the further communications because, well, they broke their word. You
right.
know, fool me once, you know, shame on you. They give the benefit of the doubt, but the second they see something, they figure, well, this is another – anything else they say is going to be stalling, is going to be another trick. They do this – and we don't even really know what this web does, but it seems to just trap them, you know? I think if they were violent, they would have just immediately – you know, they attack, but
– Well, they do fire on the Enterprise.
But they don't attack then en masse. They get another thing to do this web thing.
Yeah, that's the interesting part of the episode, at least where the Tholians are concerned, because we don't – yeah, like you said, we don't really know what the web is supposed to do other than just trap them. And Spock does say that if the Tholians complete their web, that they're not leaving, right? And so I guess the implication there is that
– I assume they were going to take them prisoner. Like they fire on the ship to disable it maybe even because that's what they do.
Yeah,
that's
like it seems like maybe that's just the Tholian MO there, which is they disengage and then they fire on a ship to disable it, and then they do the web and they capture them, and then they do whatever they're going
to
do with their leisure.
Whether they tow them back to Tholia, you know, is their prerogative.
Right. So I like that, and I think it adds a little bit of – it's obviously there to add some more – some more drama to the situation and some more suspense to the situation, because we have this other alternate thing going on, of course, which is that, you know, the episode starts out with them answering a distress call from the USS Defiant. They beam over, everyone's dead, they don't know why. And then it turns out that the Defiant disappears with Kirk on it into this thing called Interspace, I think.
Yeah, it's a between dimensions, I guess.
Right. And so the whole conception of the Tholian web is that Spock is staying here so that he can attempt another rescue of Kirk. And that's why they can't go anywhere, and that's why the Tholians are a problem.
Yeah. What I thought was really interesting was how normally when we see Spock, Spock is the incarnation of the needs of the many outweighing the needs of the few. And here it is he who is risking this entire ship for what he feels are good odds for rescuing Kirk. And, you know, it's McCoy who's saying, you know, you should have left. You should have, you know, I don't know why you didn't leave. And he even says, like, if you get out of this, you're going to be captain, you know. He's kind of implying that Spock wants Kirk dead. They have again, even with all of the plot things, they have a lot of very interesting character stuff going on between
them. I felt the same way about the episode. I actually think it's a decent character episode.
That's what turns it into, I'd say, from just a decent episode to a very good episode, actually.
Yeah.
It gives it more of a heft.
I wonder about that, though, especially the Spock and McCoy stuff, because... And I want to get your opinion on it, because, of course, we've got this other thread in the episode, which is that the interspace affects the humanoid brain in such a way that it sort of breaks down their inhibitions or something and causes them to become sort of like violent and paranoid. And so it happens to Chekhov, and it happens to a few other people. And, of course, it happens to Chekhov first because he is violent and crazy and kind of rapey. So it would affect him first because it's much closer to the surface.
Yeah, he does. It seems that Chekhov doesn't really need much of an excuse to start raping people. I think he's just, you know, every week I think there's another HR complaint. You know, Captain, it was an alien mind ray, those Cossacks. And it's like, all right, mind ray this week. Like, all right, well, the week before it was a hate plague. And then, you know, you had a mental beam. And then there was a poisonous spore, like...
So, you know, I'm not really sure if we're supposed to interpret that as, because, you know, I'm not sure if we're supposed to interpret that as an effect of the interspace on their brains causing them to argue more than they otherwise would, or if they're just supposed to be normal in arguing, because obviously McCoy and Spock have an antagonistic relationship.
Yeah.
And they don't always see eye to eye. They don't always get along. And they don't always agree, but at the same time, there's a grudging respect there. There's an admiration there. And they do, I think, at least professionally like each other. So, you know, but the disagreements that they're having in the episode seem almost like taken to an absurd degree.
Well, to be fair.
And I don't necessarily buy it.
To be fair, Kirk, as far as they know, is dead. So neither of them, you know. Kirk is both of their best friend and confidant, and the reason Spock and McCoy work so well together normally is because they're able to kind of mitigate the relationship through Kirk. And with Kirk removed, they have to deal with each other directly. This is in some ways another of those, you know, the Gemini, the Galileo 7, that one. One of the things they made is Spock on his own has this impeccable logic and is, you know, extremely intelligent and is able to read situations very well. But when, you know, logic has its limits, and Spock's biggest flaw is that he fails to recognize the limits of his logic. Anytime logic doesn't work, Spock is almost shocked at it. He seems to...
Yeah.
You know, so...
And that's...
I think he may think that, you know, making this decision was the logical decision. Maybe he... You know, he miscalculated something. He didn't, you know, what it turns out is that firing, you know, messed up interspace so that, you know, Kirk came out at a different spot, basically.
Right.
And, you know, that's something Spock was not able to predict. So for him, I think he felt there was less of a risk. And McCoy is making it clear that, no, you know, from the human side, there were all of these people you should have thought about.
You know, it's weird though, because McCoy is put kind of in the Spock role in this episode, where he's telling Spock that, yeah, the needs of the many do outweigh the needs of the few, and you need to take the ship, and you're the captain now, and you need to do your duty. But I think, you know, the weird thing is, at the same time, McCoy kind of steps back from accusing him of murdering Kirk to become captain. And that just seems weird to me because, and maybe this is just a third season problem, but the motivations there seem counterintuitive, because at the same time that McCoy is lambasting Spock for staying put and trying to rescue Kirk to the detriment of and to the safety of the entire crew, he's also saying, hey, you kind of want to be captain, so you're not trying to rescue Kirk. And it's weird.
Well, again, I think that that accusation could have existed with a better framing, as in, you know, it could make sense for Bones to be saying that to just lash out at Spock because he's just blaming the first person who's there. Spock was in charge at the time, and, you know, even though it's not really Spock's fault per se, McCoy wants to blame somebody because he doesn't want it to be just Kirk died because of an accident.
Yeah.
I mean, that could be a lot of that.
That makes sense. And I mean, McCoy does step back a couple times.
Well, what happened?
And apologizes to Spock, which I think is nice as well. So,
and what happens is, you know, Kirk is very, you know, the reason Kirk, you know, works so well with the two of them is because he's very intuitively able to consider both sides, and Kirk is very easily able to synthesize their two input. When the two of them don't have Kirk there, you know, they're frictioning against each other. And they are dealing with very different things. Spock has to have a more strategic view of the situation because he's acting as captain. McCoy is seeing this plague that, for the most of it, he realizes is a factor of space. And he doesn't necessarily think for a lot of the episode that there is a possible cure for it. Like, he just thinks it's a miasma in the air, and getting them out of there is the only thing that will work. So,
right.
You know, he keeps telling Spock this, and Spock keeps staying. And, you know, McCoy is seeing the situation get worse and worse. McCoy knows that he's not going to be, you know, able to, you know, once he sees Uhura seemingly succumb to the plague, he's realizing, you know, oh God, main cast members are starting to get affected by this, you know?
Chekhov was the first affected, but nobody cares about Chekhov.
They hoped for that.
I do like the fact that amongst all of this horribleness, the sick bay crew does take the time to change the affected out of their uniforms into those nice blue get-ups.
They were very nice. Yeah. Well, you know, keep them comfortable.
Exactly.
But you have to see, like, Chekhov naked.
Oh God.
I loved, by the way, Uhura's little nightstand. It was like it like revolves from like a table and then like has her chest of drawers and a vanity, and like that's very space conscious. Like, because on a spaceship you don't have that much room, and you know, you have a lot of you know, you want to have your drawers for your clothes, but you also want to have like, you know, something you can put like photos or whatever on. So I think that makes a lot of sense. And she has this nice little zebra theme going on. You know, she's got this really cool little robe.
She looks
good.
She's
styling.
Yeah. Do you think that the whole Kirk appearing kind of works? I'm kind of on the fence about it. I mean, I think it works to some degree because it does give them an impetus to actually effect another rescue attempt. Because of course we all know that Kirk is not going to be dead at the end of the episode, and they do need to figure out a way to get him. It's maybe a problem with the episode as it's constructed on a whole level, because I don't really necessarily think that the interspace stuff and interfacing into interspace is ever really explained very well.
I just figured it's a between dimensions.
Yeah.
But I've read the Dark Tower series by Stephen King, so
right.
You'll understand.
When I get there, yeah, I'll understand. It's, yeah, and so I kind of feel like that's not very well explained. Is it all that important? Not really, but I feel like it's a lacking element in the episode, primarily because it's a plot hole, and the third season episodes usually have a couple of them. And that's why I bring it up, basically.
I honestly felt like a lot of this episode, up till the Will, which I do want to talk about.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I felt that this episode, and maybe even with that, I felt like this episode was made because Shatner just wanted a week off, you know, and they couldn't.
I was wondering about that. I was like, did his mother die? Did he go back home to Canada? Like, what was going on?
I think he was just had a run of shitty episodes and just said, look, put me in as little as possible. Like, so what he had, I mean, he did a day's worth of filming probably in this episode.
Yeah, if that.
And so they just, I think he just took a vacation, you know.
He's in the very beginning of the episode before the cold open.
Yeah.
And then he's in the very end of the episode, and he appears a couple times as a ghost. And
which took him 15 minutes to do.
Yeah, they probably just used the same footage of him going, oh.
Yeah, yeah. Just scream for 5 minutes, and they just took this, couple clips of that.
Yeah.
So, the will is interesting because that's, it is from then that they do, they point, it's where he explains to Spock, look, you need to temper this with human, McCoy, I know you don't like Spock, but he's the person I've chosen to, lead in my stead, so you gotta listen to him,
I think it's interesting because it serves a really... kind of serves a kind of a distressing purpose almost, right? Because we've talked before about how McCoy and Spock need Kirk.
Yeah.
And now Kirk is ostensibly dead and is not coming back. So, and they're immediately at each other's throats. And maybe that's to the episode's credit that it's that smart, that it realizes these characters that intently and knows that without Kirk, the relationship would start to sour. And so it makes sense if you think about it in those terms that Kirk, he's the best of the best. He's a great starship captain. He really understands the needs of his crew, psychologically.
Yeah, he knows what when McCoy's getting upset about Spock, he knows what to say to McCoy. When Spock's getting, dicky to McCoy, he knows what to say to Spock. Like, again,
that's something we've seen time and time again throughout the series. So it does make sense that Kirk would realize that if he was dead, he would need to kind of, and it's interesting because he basically, the role of the will in this episode, the last video that Kirk made of himself is kind of daddy making explicit what you need to do to get along with your brothers.
But what I think is interesting is that what Captain Kirk figured, like, if I die, and as a starship captain, he knows what the series has been. He knows that that can happen at any time.
Sure.
Him realizing that the first thing he needs to do, the most important thing he needs to do, is to give this lecture. I mean, that's... which turns out to be the exact thing that they two need to hear. Like,
yeah.
I think that kind of shows it may come off as a little cheesy, and it certainly does to a degree, but it does fit him realizing, like, again, this, they need to hear this. And from that point on, McCoy and Spock do, that's when McCoy starts apologizing. That's when, Spock starts being more patient with, McCoy. And the implication I would get would be that while their next while is not going to be the easiest time, they're at least, they had their daddy lecture and they're not going to forget that. Neither of them are going to forget their best friend's, last will and testament. So if Kirk really were dead, they would at least begin to make the steps necessary.
Yeah, because of course, if Kirk is actually dead, once they get out of this situation and they go back to a starbase, and Spock is promoted to captain officially and is awarded the Enterprise, and he needs to find a new science officer, and he has to work with McCoy in that respect. So, I don't think that McCoy is going to request a new assignment because Kirk is dead and Spock is now captain. I think he wants to stay on the Enterprise. And the funny thing is, you always talk about, what would this show be like if it was more, you always say continuity, but I think more serialized. And I think, the relationships in the show, I think, are more serialized than the actual, events of the show.
Yeah.
And that's just due to the fact that the show was made in the 60s and people came in and out of shows time.
Yeah, we've seen occasional references,
and
things like, Mud reappearing, things like that, but nothing significant, I would say.
The Romulans, the Klingons.
Nothing that, if I didn't see the first Harry Mudd episode, I would still understand the second episode. There's nothing like that.
Exactly. But I think it's interesting because, we always have had this McCoy and Spock relationship and Kirk sort of intuitively understanding how to talk each one of them down. And in this episode, he actually makes it explicit. And not only does he make it explicit to the audience, he makes it explicit in universe to Spock and McCoy. Yeah. And I feel like, like I've said before, I haven't seen a majority of the third season. I've only ever seen about, maybe a half of it, a third of it, something like that. And so I'm curious to see if that carries over into other episodes that were filmed after this, because I really feel like Kirk being that explicit with them and saying, no, listen, this is what your relationship is. This is what your relationship needs. I feel like that would have a profound effect on both of them. And I think it would color their relationship going forward. I'm not optimistic that that actually carries over into the show.
Yeah.
Like, and that's probably a problem.
But I would assume past then that, you know, McCoy would be a little more sensitive about making, you know, green blood jokes, for example.
Right. Right.
Or, you know, just they would be sniping a little less
and,
at each
and
other.
And Spock would needle McCoy a little less because Spock McCoy, Spock needles McCoy.
And they will, and again, they will, Spock will always needle McCoy because he enjoys it. And, you know, McCoy will always, you know, be impatient with Spock and find fault with, you know, just a logical worldview. And that will never change. At the end of the day, they are very different people. But
yeah,
they need to learn how to work together more effectively, I would say.
Yeah, totally. And I, you know, and
so
I,
that's their performance goals for this next fiscal year.
But I think the very end of the episode shows that maybe they're starting to do that a little bit.
Yeah.
Because they find Kirk, they're able to beam him back. Kirk is on the bridge, and it's one of those. And this is again why it's a good episode of the show, because it kind of feeds into a lot of the beats that we expect from a Star Trek episode, and it does it well. You've got the last scene of the episode, which is the three of them on the bridge having a chat like they do. And Spock and McCoy are sort of ganging up on Kirk a little bit. And you don't see that much. It's usually Kirk in the middle mediating between McCoy and Spock. And there's this whole thing where Kirk is like, oh, you watched my last orders. And they kind of look at each other and they're like, nah, we didn't do that. What are you talking about? And it's like them bonding a little bit.
Put it this way.
They putting the wool over Kirk's eyes a little bit, which I like.
They've both worked with, you know, Kirk alone, they've worked as a trio, but we don't really see much time where the two of them have to rely on each other. And frankly, you and another person get through an extremely stressful situation, it does bring you closer together, you know?
Yeah.
This episode was frankly a bond, you know, this is a camping weekend between Spock and McCoy.
Yeah. That's true. The other thing that I like about the episode, and these are little moments, but the return of the Triox compound from a Muck time. That was kind of cool. Just a little bit of continuity there. And then I also like when the sickbay orderly is attacking McCoy and Nurse Chapel sneaks over with a hypospray and sticks it at him. It's like, oh, Nurse Chapel saving the day.
Yeah.
I like that too. And just little things like that that just make it it's you know, I don't want to oversell the episode because it's definitely not like top 10, top 20 episode at all. It has its problems. Some of it's not very well explained. The denouement of the episode where they sort of like deus ex machina their way out of the web and suddenly everything is fine doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
But it did. It's one of those episodes where I didn't care.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Sometimes, you know, there are, and this was a problem with Alternative Factor where everything, or the Return to Tomorrowland or whatever the hell that one where they go to the 60s.
Return to Tomorrow.
The future is yesterday, Mission Earth, the Geddon.
I
don't know. But
are you talking about the one with the magic
I'm talking
cat?
I'm talking about a lot of bad ones.
Okay.
We're at the end, whatever the problem gets solved because Kirk declares it's what they're going to do is going to solve it and they only have 5 minutes left. So
yeah.
That, you know, in Alternative Factor, in Return to Tomorrow, that sucked because the rest of the episode sucked, and it felt cheap. In this, there was so much else going on that I wasn't really interested in the mechanics of the problem so much as the problem compounding itself or the reaction to the problem, I guess.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm okay with them declaring it solved.
Yeah, it makes sense. Is there anything else we can talk about the Tholian web?
I'm ready to tribble this out.
Okay.
I would give this 7 little tribbles.
7, wow.
As I was watching it, it was very up in the air because every time they added a new element, I'm like, you know, shit, too many balls in the air.
Yeah, I was about to say,
And I would say my impression of the episode was very favorably just because there were no threads that I think they forgot. They didn't. I think they tied everything well. They resolved everything fairly well. And just the fact that it felt very, it was a solid episode was surprising to me. I didn't think they'd be able to do it because normally when they have such a plot heavy episode, they can't do it.
Something drops. Yeah. And they didn't drop anything in this
so
episode.
So was it, you know, I liked the McCoy Spock stuff. I liked the Tholian costume. You know, I thought the web was cool. It had enough, and I was never bored in this episode.
Okay, good. Yeah, I mean, you know, 7 is accurate, I think. Maybe a 6. I'm kind of between 6 and 7, so we'll leave it there.
You're at 6s and 7s with this?
Yeah, there you
go. That's actually where that comes from, right?
Well, if we're done with the Tholian web...
And we must be.
We can now break out of the web and move on to Plato's Stepchildren.
I feel like this is one of those episodes where all of the elements were fine, but they just... didn't really know what to do with any of them, and I am not sure I have an opinion about this episode. It was just kind of 50 minutes of moving images and sound on screen.
I honestly have no idea why I feel like this, and maybe this is what we can do with this time, but I love this episode.
Okay.
I've never seen it before.
Okay.
I don't know why I like it so much, but I really liked it.
See, it's weird because I could see us having the opposite reaction. You know, I like the more goofy, campy ones. And this is goofy, campy.
But you know what's interesting about it, though, is that it is a little bit campy. But at the same time, I think it's supposed to be. And I know that camp is unintentional, but I kind of feel like they knew what they were doing in this episode, unlike something like Spock's Brain, they were making a great episode.
We'll put it this way. One of the, these aliens, these Platonians, are in universe explicitly humiliating, you know, Kirk and Spock. They're making, you know, Spock dance the tarantella on Kirk's face it's stupid and weird, and when he's singing, it's a goofy song. But it's to humiliate. It's supposed to be degrading.
They have a literally powerless little person who is their slave. I mean, like the there's no subtext in this episode. It's all text, yeah. But it's like wow. Like I just imagine they knew exactly what they were doing, right? Because okay, let's set this up because. The episode dispenses with setup. Like, there basically is no setup. They have a cold open. They beam down to this planet where there's a distress signal. Some guy is dying from a scratch. And McCoy's like, what the fuck? How did this happen? This should not have happened. This should have been treated immediately. And then after the credits, they're kind of like, the Platonians, who used to live on Earth 2,500 years ago and then left and now are immortal and also have mind control powers... we are there to help them. And it's like none of that was explained at all. And you could see that in another episode, that whole thing would have taken 20 minutes. But they just get rid of it in like 30 seconds. And you're like, okay, this is what the episode is. And then they just go right into it.
Well, I talked about how they had students writing this. Obviously, this is somebody who's just read The Republic and... also wanted to write a start. Again, this...
You are actually not far off.
Well, I read The Republic. Because... I know what... I...
Well, I actually want to get into that because my knowledge of Greek philosophers is very lacking. I did not have a very good classical education, and I'm assuming that you had a better one than I did.
Yeah, I did.
But I will say that the two people that wrote this episode were actually trying to raise money. I read about this on Memory Alpha. We're actually trying to raise money to go to, like, Spain or Mexico or somewhere. And so they were basically just like students who wrote a spec script and got it accepted because it's third season Star Trek and whatever.
Yeah, true. Well, the Republic basically is Plato's model of an ideal society. And obviously it's been years since I've read it, but, you know, it goes into, you know, you have these philosopher kings and you have these, you know, this is how society should be set up. And it's a society dealt towards, you know, the mind. And this episode is kind of... It's a very flimsy reason as to how this is set up, but essentially, thought experiment. Let's look at this situation in real life. What is necessary to Because obviously he's talking about his utopia as if it's great.
Sure.
There are, you know, examining...
And it's great for them.
Yeah. This is examining that from the outside and saying, okay, well, it's actually not very great. It's very oppressive. It's very totalitarian. And keep this Scream 9. This is the same episode that features the first interracial kiss. Like, they did know what they were doing.
Well, we'll get into that.
Yeah, but... I mean, I would say that it's not coincidental that they're the same episode.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. And, you know, I'd be talking out of my ass because I don't know much about Greek philosophy. But it seems to me that what the episode is trying to tease out a little bit in having these people develop this, what they consider to be a utopia. I mean, a literal utopia. I mean, we all know where utopia comes from. I do not. I'm just pretending that I do, but let's go with it.
Thomas More wrote a novel called Utopia, meaning no place.
How would they know the word utopia? I don't know, but let's leave it.
Well, because it's a Greek word.
Is it? Yeah. See, I don't know anything about Greek.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about anything. I don't know anything about Star Trek. I'm faking it. I don't know. This actually isn't even being released on the internet.
Oh.
This is just these episodes. I'm not even recording right now.
Really?
Yeah, I've been fooling you this whole time.
Wow.
You
haven't been fooling me. I'm actually not really Richard.
Oh, my God.
Hello. How are you?
You're actually Alexander, the little person who I love.
Hey, it's adorable.
Don't say that. That's offensive.
It's nice to see one of those roles not going to Warwick Davis, though. Peter Dinklage. I mean, they've like got the fucking monopoly on that. Nice to see them giving, you know, someone else a chair.
It would have been a little hard for Peter Dinklage to be in this episode because he was about 4 at the time.
Yeah, but I mean, he's playing a little person, so it doesn't really... Oh, that was mean.
Yeah, don't go there.
Yeah, that's... I think you should edit that out.
Yeah, I'm not going to.
Oh.
You're a little person racist, and that's going out on the internet.
I'm not a little person racist. I don't...
You're heightist.
Heightist?
Yeah. You're an ist against height.
No, I like short people.
Okay. But I'm going to force you to reinterpret this episode a little bit because I think it's a lot smarter than you're giving it credit for. Because you've got people who have set up this utopia who realize that they would like to live like this. And then they go to this planet and they set it up. And 2.5 months later, they start to get mind control powers and they have telekinesis. And it's a literal interpretation of the power of Plato and absolute power corrupts absolutely and all of these things.
No, you don't understand. I didn't dislike the episode because I didn't get it. Like, I got it. I just didn't think that was a very interesting thing.
Well, I mean, it's interesting and it's not interesting.
Well, I mean, I have read The Republic, so...
Just say that again. You've already said it twice.
I have read The Republic and Ulysses, man.
You know, you say that the episode is campy. I don't think it is. I mean, I think they knew what they were doing, and let's take this point by point.
Again, I don't really know what I mean when I say campy.
I don't think you do either. I think, you know, Shatner is Shatner in this episode. Nimoy is Nimoy in this episode. They're being forced to do things, and so I think that it works that Shatner is maybe overacting a little bit.
Yeah.
I also think it's interesting because, you know, for example, when Uhura and Chapel beam down or are forced to beam down much later in the episode, and Nimoy is singing a song to them, which he wrote, I want to point out.
I know he wanted... at least I was really worried it would be Ballad of Bilbo Baggins or something, but he really tried to have that songwriting thing work out for him, didn't he?
The song is called Made in Wine, and it features a rhyme of kegs and dregs. So I'll just leave that there. And he's also dressed in a silly hat. So there definitely is some of that third season. Yeah, this is a little ridiculous. But
I mean, we saw, you know.
But it's supposed to be.
Well, that's the thing. Because, and there are bits that are kind of horrifying about it. When you have Spock laughing, it's actually kind of terrifying.
Oh, yeah. Anytime Spock laughs or smiles is horrifying. Like, full stop. And I like the idea that the torture that they're going through is kind of ridiculous because, number one, the Platonians want to be entertained, right? So that kind of makes sense. They're not just going to like they're seen as you know, if we can kind of put like oppression and totalitarianism into two buckets, sort of like nice and not nice, for lack of better terms. And this is kind of a nice totalitarianism because they're not bloodthirsty. They're not.
They're a bunch of jocks.
Yeah, exactly.
Who are beating up freshmen. That's exactly what this is. They're a bunch of adolescent bullies. I think that
they're 2,500 years old, but they're still.
But they've never grown up because they don't need to.
Right.
Well, that's one of the issues with this. I mean, we've talked about societies which are not progressing. This society is not progressing because it doesn't need to. They're just a bunch of lazy people who are just never going to get old, never going to get sick, you know, and they just kind of hang out and do random arty shit. And so
– exactly.
You know, they're not going to do any physical torture. Number one, like physical like hurting is – they're terrified of it. Like they don't – because a simple cut can kill them.
Right.
So I don't see them as eager to put that on other people. I mean, they do whip and almost brand the ladies, but that's a thing. They're just going to make them, you know, they literally do a, why are you hitting yourself to Kirk?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's really, that's a good point because what they're doing is entertaining to them. And it's also sort of ridiculous because they don't have a good conception of what actual like psychological torture is.
But it's funny because
they're adolescents and they don't understand basically anything, and they're sort of in this arrested development.
But what I think is interesting is sort of between, you know, Kirk and Uhura, and we'll talk about the implications of that kiss in a bit, but you know, talking to it, you know, she says like, you know, what she says to him is that, you know, anytime I hear your voice or I see you, you know, I get it, comforts me, you know, and I, you know, and she said this before that, you know, the captain's bravery transfers to her, that she's able to do her job because she views him as a very respectful role model. And, you know, that's mostly what they're talking. And he's, you know, giving her like, you know, don't be afraid of this. We'll deal with this. You know?
Right.
Nurse Chapel is interesting because she does love Spock, but the way they have handled that in the series is very almost subtle. And any time, and things keep, and that's so much of a curse for her because this is like the third time that she's kissed Spock or been in a very intimate situation with him due to fucked up alien mind control stuff.
Yeah.
Like, oh, he was possessed by someone who was hitting on her at one point.
Yeah.
There was So like this time, like she's making out with Spock, which is something she may have desired at one point because, you know, she's in love with him, but they're being forced into it by a third party. I mean, that must be horrifying to her.
Oh, yeah.
She has gone through this feeling she has for him. They have used this in some very cruel ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Obviously, the Platonians don't realize the full implications of what they're doing. They're just making, again, two freshmen kiss each other.
Right, right. And that's why it's also adolescent.
It feels like a truth or dare with, you know, with psychic powers.
And let's tease this out even a little bit more, because they're doing all this because they're trying to convince McCoy to stay to be their doctor. And at first I thought that they were setting him up to be their Alexander, right? Because they have Alexander, the little person. And it's important that he's a little person because the show does not elide that information. It does not avoid it. It's very upfront with it. And he knows that he's kind of a joke among the Platonians, in part because he is shorter than them, and it's a problem. And he definitely doesn't like them because of that. He's mistreated because of that reason. And they make that literal in the script because he's the only person that lives there that doesn't have the telekinetic powers.
What I think is very interesting, though, and what the reason he ends up respecting Kirk is, there is the scene when you know, Kirk asks him, like, are there any, you know, you're the only person like you on this? And, you know, they end up clarifying, and, you know, Kirk means the, you know, lack of psychic powers.
Right.
And he doesn't even, you know, and Alexander basically is like, oh, I thought you meant, you know, my shortness. Like, and he's very, surprised and touched that that's, you know, Kirk didn't even, that wasn't really on his radar. That's,
right.
You know,
I mean, Kirk even says explicitly that, where he's like, no, we don't, in my society, yeah, we don't notice any of those things. We don't notice race. We don't notice height. You
and,
know.
You know, given the experiences he's had with all different aliens of different shapes and sizes, I mean, he's buddies with Baylock, who looks like he's 5 and is one of the most powerful entities in the universe.
Right.
You know,
so
he's not going to judge a book by its cover like that. And then there were the little guys in the Journey to Babel.
Yeah. The little guys with the fezzes. But so that's what I thought they were doing with McCoy at first. But then it turns out that in the climactic scene where they're forcing Spock and Uhura, or, I mean Spock and Chapel and Kirk and Uhura to kiss, that they actually know that McCoy will develop the telekinetic powers because he's going to be living on the planet and he's going to be eating the food, which causes this chemical buildup in their systems and causes them to have the telekinetic ability. So they actually know that they're inducting McCoy into their society as a full member.
This is like a frat initiation.
Well, tease it out. That's exactly what it is.
It's almost like they're saying, like, because to them, this is the height of hilarity.
Yeah, and so they're showing
it's 6 months from now, you're going to do this. Like, imagine the fun we are going to have. Like, I mean, for them, you know, they may be seeing, like, you know, finally you can get back at your captain. You know, what do you want to see your captain do? Like,
a
good point.
These are disagreeable people, but they're not disagreeable in ways that are unredeemable. That's the thing.
Well, because there is a story, and I don't remember if this. I think it's in the Republic, but it is in Plato's philosophy, The Ring of Gyges, which is it's this myth about this man named Gyges who finds this ring that, when he wears it, it makes him invisible. Now, this is ancient Greek. Tolkien did not invent that concept. He takes it and he, you know, starts playing little pranks on his friends. And ultimately, it ends up to he kills the king, rapes the queen. Like, he's doing all these. And the point of it is that if there is no accountability for your actions, no matter how virtuous you may think you are, you're going to be tempted into doing worse and worse stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and that's one of the explicit points of this. You know, the head of the head Plato at the end basically says, look, you know, you're right. You know, nobody should have this power because this is corrupting us. You know, even a saint would be tempted into doing something evil if you have this.
Right, right. But
which
but,
is interesting because Alexander does not. And I actually was very disturbed by the fact that Kirk and Head Plato are basically tennis racketing him back and forth at the end, and that's not addressed. But, you know, besides the point when he breaks, you know, when he breaks free.
Well, I'm confused. What would you like them to have addressed about that?
Alexander, it's your choice. Do you want to kill him? And he does get that. So it's kind of a weak point I'm making. So I rescind it. I'm sorry. Please strike that from the record.
Yeah, I just, you know, that scene read to me like Kirk was not ping-ponging Alexander back and forth because he wanted to or he was enjoying it. He was doing it because...
No, they were using him he was being used as a living weapon.
Yeah, exactly. And Kirk needed to defend himself.
Either way, and, you know,
I mean, it is a problem, of course, that the king is doing that to Alexander in the first place, but he realizes the error of his ways a little too quickly, I think. But at the same time, it makes sense because if you think about it in terms of these are adolescents and then the principal comes and tells them to stop, they kind of go, oh, yeah, okay.
No, they don't. What school did you go to?
I went to an all-boys Catholic school. That happened.
It's honestly the case of, you know, Head Plato just has never had anybody step up to him before because he's the head of it because he's the strongest, you know, and
right.
He has been for thousands of years, you know, the quarterback of the high school football team, and suddenly a nerd's punched him in the stomach. Like, that doesn't happen. Like, to these people, humiliation is a major thing. He's just been humiliated. He's never had to deal with that before. So it actually read to me very well because this is the first time that he's realized, like, oh, this really sucks. Like, he's just been he's been stuffed into the toilet for the first time and he doesn't like it.
Yeah, exactly. He doesn't like it. And I think it's important to note too that at the very end of the episode, it's left ambiguous because we don't know what's going to happen with them, but they don't have Alexander to push around anymore. Because he leaves with them.
Yeah, I was a little surprised at that because a lot of times they don't let them go off the planet, you know, at the end. But, you know, yeah, I thought that was a very nice touch because there is really nothing for Alexander on this planet at this point. He's done with that scene. Even if he doesn't want to turn it around and be the leader of that, and it doesn't look like getting to an equal society is going to happen anytime soon.
Right.
So... you know, maybe it's almost implied. Yeah, I don't know. He mentions to Scotty. Maybe he's going to be an engineer then. That would be cute. He could, like, crawl into the ship's ducts, like, so easily. Alexander would be a really great engineer. He's really good with, like, sharp tools.
Yeah, yeah, that's
he's
true.
He's good at breaking vases, which you need as an engineer.
Sure.
And I would picture him looking really cute in a little kilt with a bagpipe. And, like, he can dress just like Scotty and they can do a little dance together. This is going to be a great spinoff.
Richard, what do you think engineering is?
I really don't know. I saw a textbook once and it looked very hard. So I just made up my own imagination of it.
Okay. Let's talk about the kiss.
Oh, yes.
We need to.
It was not a very sexy kiss. It wasn't supposed to be a sexy kiss, but it was not a sexy kiss.
There's a lot of history behind this kiss because it is viewed as the first interracial kiss on television, which it is actually not.
Really?
No. It's weird because I think a lot of
what
this
was the first.
It's kind of
okay.
Okay, so if you really want to get into it, technically Star Trek even had an interracial kiss before this because there's an episode which had not aired yet, but had been filmed before. I think it was A Lot of Troyes, but I'm not sure, where Kirk kisses an Asian American actress.
Vern Troyer, that was another small actor. No.
Yes. So that is actually something. And then also they sort of like elided a little bit where they say that it's the first it's the first kiss between a fictional black woman and a fictional white man on American television. Which is a lot less impressive.
It's the first interracial kiss between Nichelle Nichols and William Shatner on the episode Plato's Stepchildren of Star Trek.
Yeah, because something about like Sammy Davis Jr. and I think Nancy Sinatra kissed or something on like an award show, like a kiss on the cheek. And then on British television, there was like an interracial kiss between
she was one of his best friend's daughters. I would hope it would not be a sexy kiss. I would hope it would just be a, you know.
Yeah.
Warm, affectionate, friendly kiss.
And so there's a lot of like history behind this and a lot of like kind of machinations behind is this actually the first kiss or not?
I mean,
it doesn't really matter that much.
Yeah, either way, it is a major it is a important thing.
It's an important thing, and I think it's interesting because there's a lot of bad information about it. Number one being that it was the first interracial kiss on American television. Number two, that the NBC executives were really worried about it. There's conflicting reports about this, but on the whole, I don't buy they were really worried about it.
I read somewhere that they had to film an alternate version for, like, the Southern market, but, like, they... like Shatner crossed his eyes.
There's actually, I think it was in Nichelle Nichols' memoir where she wrote about that. And she said that, they did have to film two versions of that scene, one with the kiss and one without, and William Shatner really hammed up the non-kissing scenes, rolling, you know, crossing his eyes and being like, I won't kiss you. Like that kind of stuff,
yeah, to make fun of that scene and which is awesome,
that the takes would be unusable and they would have to use the one with the kiss.
Yeah,
in it. So that's and I don't think that the NBC executives were really all that worried about it because from
was failing
from what I well they're not even that reason. It was just that it was 1968 and they were fairly progressive. I mean, they didn't really care about having Uhura on the bridge. In fact, they liked it. They didn't really care about having Sulu on the bridge. And from what I've read of the producers on the show, their dealings with the NBC executives, they never had any sort of like racial issues with the show whatsoever. So I don't really buy that NBC cared that much. If anything, they may have gotten a little bit of pushback from some of their Southern affiliates, but yeah. every credible source I've ever read has said that they didn't even really get that many complaints about it. So
anything, you get a couple of the crazy Baptists, but
yeah. The other interesting thing I think about the kiss is that they don't kiss.
Well, they just have like a pressing their lips on each other kiss.
I don't even mean that. I don't even think they're touching. Like they film it.
I couldn't
it.
Tell from the angle.
That's 100%. That's the thing.
There was no tongue.
This is what I find interesting about this is that in the same way that gay characters on television were kissing, 5, 10, 15 years ago, where they sort of do it at weird angles so you can kind of tell that they're not really kissing, but you're not sure. Whereas, you know, the straight characters on television are just like making out and everything, and you can totally see it, like the camera is like right there. They did the same thing with this kiss, where they shoot it at a weird angle. Are their lips actually touching? You can't tell, but it looks like it. They're only on it for like 3 seconds. Whereas when Spock and Uhura and Nurse Chapel are kissing, it's just like, let's just show them making out.
Yeah, but that's interracial too.
Well, I mean, it is and it isn't.
I mean, no. He was Jewish.
No, I know. I know that's what you mean.
Yeah.
But, you know.
I'm coming up very bigoted this episode. I don't think that's very good.
Was Majel Barrett Jewish? I wonder. I don't know if she was, actually. She may have been.
Oh, then that's okay.
Yeah, it's okay then. Yeah, Richard, sure.
Well, you know, what will the children be if they're not, you know, they're different religions?
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, I guess that's really all we can say about the kiss, but it's interesting. It's kind of important.
I felt a little anticlimactic about it.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's really not that much there, honestly. It's important. It's a footnote in history. But at the end of the day, it is what it is. And looking back on it now, it doesn't seem all that impressive.
Well, but again, I think it's kind of nice that it doesn't seem all that impressive because, you know, that kind of means that to us, an interracial kiss is just literally not a thing. We're very unimpressed by it.
Oh, yeah. No, totally. I mean,
you know, I'm still like watching 6 Feet Under. I still find myself surprised by the gay sex scenes because they are, you know, still TV doesn't really get that, you know, in depth into it. The fact that, you know, again, the fact that this isn't a thing means that we have moved on from that.
Yeah, no, I think you're right.
So thank you, Star Trek, for, you know, at the very least, even if it wasn't the first interracial kiss, it may have been the first significant one.
And it happened, and it was another line on the long road to where we are today.
Yes.
Which is nice.
Which is recording a podcast.
And it also, you know, kept Nichelle Nichols happy because I think she really enjoyed doing that.
Can you blame it?
Yeah. Although, you know, I'm saying the toga look, not great for Shatner. He was kind of hitting the craft services table a little too much at this point.
And, hey, you know something? I'm good with it. I'm good with it.
He's looking a little chunky.
I can deal with a little bit of meat on the bones. I realized that, like, one of the bands, my band played show this weekend, and one of the guys had, like, a total V, and I realized I don't like guys with abs.
Okay.
It's creepy.
Yeah. The other thing I like about this episode is, and this is why, I more highly regard it than you do, I think, is that it's got a lot of great lines. Like, it's pretty well written. You know, there's things like the very beginning where the wife of the king is asking Spock to guess how old she is, and he's like 35, and she's like, I stopped aging at 30.
Well, specifically, she says, you know, go on, I'm not vain, you know. And she knows that the answer is like 2,000, you know, 2,500 years. So,
yeah.
You know, she knows no matter what. So she's like coming off. And then she gets so upset. And that was the only really note of her character that I found. Like, I thought I would like her a lot more from that line just because
she's kind of a non-entity.
Yeah. But that was great because it totally characterizes her as, she wants to appear above pettiness, above vanity, above, you know, the bullshit, but she is so into it. You know, she really isn't used to being, you know, at that point, 5 years is completely irrelevant, and she looks fine no matter whether she's 30 or 35.
But again,
the fact that she gets offended by it.
And she would, though, because, again, they're adolescents.
That's
and
it.
So she,
yeah.
she has that mindset.
And she's never had anybody who's. Everybody knows that she stopped aging at 30. So she has nobody telling her that she looks young. Old.
Exactly. Yeah. There's Alexander's great line, "What do you mean, people like me?"
Yeah.
Which actually means people without mental abilities, but he thinks it's a crack on his height because that's how he lives.
At the beginning, you know, even the title drop, he says we're Plato's children, and say we're more his stepchildren.
His stepchildren, yeah, that's a great line. I love Scotty's line where he says, "I don't know, sir, and those are the facts." Like, it's almost a meta commentary on that, but at the same time, it's really funny and it's a great line, so I just went with it.
Yeah. Well, good job for the Plato.
And then the very end, of course, when they're beaming up with Alexander and Kirk says to Scotty, "I have a little surprise for you."
Aw. Oh my God, though. In the 2009 Star Trek movie, Scotty's hanging out with that tiny dude.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God, continuity!
That's not Alexander. I wish it was.
But maybe he takes off his mask and it's Alexander, or like after like years he mutates.
Okay, maybe.
He's eating the food and it's causing him to have like a normal face, but they have like really weird faces on that, like he breaks out into like that weird face when he stops eating the food. I'm just throwing out
some
theories.
So you think the Plutonians actually look like dinosaurs, but when they stop eating the food they will revert back to their dinosaur form?
I really want to write this fan fiction.
All right. I think little things like that, I wish that the writers of this episode had written another Star Trek episode, because I like what they do with it. And it's kind of a goofy episode, yeah. But I think there's a lot there. It's Star Trek when it is thoughtful, and the third season has not been very thoughtful. It tries to deal with some, you know, thorny political issues, some philosophical issues. There's sort of like these disagreements of philosophy in this episode, which we don't really see in the third season all that much.
Yeah.
I like it. I think it's a pretty decent episode. So
I'm liking the episode better now that we've talked about it. It's one of those episodes to me that I think is more interesting to talk about than to watch.
That could be. I'm going to give it an 8. I'm going to go crazy.
I would give it a 5.
Okay, good. So next week, we are going to cover Wink of an Eye and The Empath. So join us then.